introduced me to two handsome women who had long jet-black hair that fanned down over their bare backs. The older woman had a tattoo of three vertical stripes on her upper arms, and the younger one wore a necklace with glittering white shells. "My wives," Vajuvi said. Before long, more people stepped out of the shadows. Children and grandchildren, sons-in-law and daughters-in-law, aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters. Vajuvi said that nearly 20 people lived in the house. It seemed less like a home than like a self-contained village. In the center of the room, near a pole supporting the roof, from which corn had been hung to dry, one of Vajuvi's daughters knelt in front of a large wooden loom, weaving a hammock, and next to her was a boy wearing a blue beaded belt, holding fish in an elaborately detailed, brightly painted ceramic pot. And beside him, an elderly hunter sat on a large hardwood bench carved in the shape of a jaguar, sharpening a 5-foot-long arrow. Fawcett wrote of the southern basin of the Amazon, "The whole of this region is saturated with Indian traditions of a most interesting kind, which cannot be founded upon nothing, and which suggest the prior presence of a once great civilization." The village, which had about 150 residents, was highly stratified. These people were not wandering hunter-gatherers. Chiefs were anointed by bloodlines, as with European kings. There were taboos on diet which forbade them to eat most red meats, including tapir, deer, and boar, dietary restrictions that were among the strictest of any in the world, and seemed to contradict the notion that the Indians were threatened with a constant state of starvation. At puberty, boys and girls were held in extended seclusion, during which a designated elder taught them the rituals and the responsibilities of adulthood. The son, who was in line to become chief, was sequestered for up to 4 years. Diet, during his journey in the Xingu with Aloike, passed through the Kalapalo village and was so impressed by the scene that he wrote, "There is reason to believe that Fawcett's stories of a forgotten civilization are based on fact." I asked Vajuvi whether he knew if the people of this region, who were known as the Xinguanos, had once descended from a larger civilization, or if there were any significant ruins in the surrounding jungle. He shook his head. According to legend, however, the spirit Fitzi Fitzi built giant moats in the area. Everywhere he went that seemed like a nice place to stay, Fitzi Fitzi would make long, deep ditches and leave part of his people there, and he himself would continue traveling. While Vajuvi, Paolo, and I were talking, a man named Vanite Kalapalo entered the house and sat down beside us. He seemed despondent. It was his job, he said, to guard one of the posts on the reservation. The other day, an Indian had come to him and said, "Listen, Vanite, you must come with me down the river. The white people are building something at Afasukugu." The word Afasukugu meant the place of the big cats. At this site, the Xinguanos believe, the first humans were created. Vanite picked up a stick and drew a map on the mud floor. "Here is Afasukugu," he said. "It is by a waterfall." "It is outside the park," Vajuvi, the chief, added. "But it is sacred." I remembered Fawcett had mentioned in one of his last letters that he had learned from the Indians of a sacred waterfall in the same area, which he hoped to visit. Vanite continued with his story. So I said, "I will go with you to Afasukugu, but you are crazy. Nobody would build anything at the place of the jaguars. But when I get there, the waterfall is destroyed. They blew it up with 30 kilos of dynamite. The place was so beautiful, and now it is gone. And I ask a man working there, 'What are you doing?' He says, 'We are building a hydroelectric dam.' It is in the middle of the Kuluane River," Vajuvi said. "All the water from there flows right into our park and into our territory." Vanite, who was becoming agitated, didn't seem to hear the chief. He said, "A man from the Mato Grosso government comes to the Xingu and tells us, 'Do not worry, this dam will not hurt you.' And he offers each of us money. One of the chiefs from another tribe took the money, and the tribes are now fighting with each other. For me, the money means nothing. The river has been here for thousands of years. We don't live forever, but the river does. The god Taugi created the river. It gives us our food, our medicines. You see, we don't have a well. We drink water right from the river. How will we live without it? Vajuvi said, If they succeed, the river will disappear, and with it, all our people. Our search for Fawcett and the city of Zee suddenly felt trivial. Another tribe appeared to be on the verge of extinction. But later that night, after we bathed in the river, Vajuvi said there was something he had to tell Paolo and me about the Englishman. The next day, he promised, he would take us by boat to where the bones had been discovered. Before going to bed, he added, There are many things about the Englishman that only Kalapalo people know. The next morning, as we got ready to depart, one of the girls in our house removed a piece of cloth from a large object in the corner of the room, near an array of masks. Underneath was a television set, which was powered by the village's sole generator. The girl turned a knob, sat down on the mud floor, and began watching a cartoon featuring a raucous woody woodpecker-like bird. Within minutes, at least 20 other children and several adults from the village had gathered around the set. As Vajuvi came to retrieve us, I asked him how long he had owned a television. Only a few years, he said. At first, all everyone did is stare at it in a trance. But now I control the generator, and it is on only a few hours a week. Several of the men watching the television got their bows and arrows and went out to hunt. Meanwhile, Paolo and I followed Vajuvi and one of his sons, who was 5 years old, down to the river. I thought we would catch our lunch, the way Kalapalos do, Vajuvi said. We climbed into one of the motorboats and headed upriver. A mist that covered the forest slowly dissipated as the sun rose. The river, dark and muddy, occasionally narrowed into a chute so tight that tree branches hung over our heads like bridges. Eventually, we entered an inlet covered by a tangle of floating leaves. The Green Lagoon, Vajuvi said. He cut the engine and the boat slid quietly through the water. Terns with yellow beaks fluttered amid the rosewood and cedar trees, and swallows zigzagged above the lagoon, shimmering white specks on the blanket of green. A pair of macaws cackled and screamed, and on the shore deer stood as still as the water. A small caiman scurried up the banks. You must always be careful in the jungle, Vajuvi said. I listen to my dreams. If I have a dream of danger, then I stay in the village. Many accidents happen to white people because they don't believe their dreams. The Xinguanos were famous for fishing with bows and arrows, their bodies perched silently on the fronts of canoes, a pose that Jack and Raleigh had excitedly caught on camera, sending the images back to the Museum of the American Indian. Vajuvi and his son, however, took out some fishing lines and baited the hooks. Then they spun the lines over their heads like lassos and sent the hooks sailing into the center of the lagoon. As Vajuvi pulled in his line, he pointed to the shore and said, Up that way is where the bones were dug up. But they were not Fawcett's bones. They were my grandfather's. Your grandfather's? I asked. Yes, Mugika, that was his name. He was dead when Orlando Villas Boas began to ask about Fawcett. Orlando wanted to protect us from all the white people coming in, and he told the Kalapalo people, If you find a tall skeleton, I will give each of you a rifle. My grandfather was one of the tallest men in the village, so several people in the village decided to dig up his bones and bury them out here by the lagoon, and they say they are Fawcett's. As he spoke, his son's line went taut. He helped the boy pull it in, and a silvery white fish burst out of the water, flapping wildly on the hook. I leaned in to inspect it, but Vajuvi jerked me out of the way and began to club it with a stick. Piranha, he said. I looked down at the fish, with its low-hung jaw, lying on the aluminum floor of the boat. Vajuvi opened its mouth with a knife, revealing a set of sharp, interlocking teeth, teeth that the Indians sometimes used to scrape their flesh in purification rituals. After he removed the hook, he continued, My father, Tachui, was away at the time, and he was furious when he found out what the people did. But the bones had already been taken away. Other evidence seemed to corroborate his story. As Brian Fawcett had noted at the time, many of the Kalapalos told contradictory versions of how the explorers had actually been killed. Some said they were clubbed, others maintained that they were shot with arrows from afar. In addition, the Kalapalos insisted that Fawcett had been murdered because he had not brought any gifts and had slapped a young Kalapalo boy. Yet this was at odds with Fawcett's long history of gentle behavior toward Indians. More significant, I later found an internal memo in the archives of the Royal Anthropological Institute in London, which had examined the bones. It stated, "The upper jaw provides the clearest possible evidence that these human remains were not those of Colonel Fawcett, whose spare upper denture is fortunately available for comparison. Colonel Fawcett is stated to have been 6 feet 1.5 inches tall. The height of the man whose remains have been brought to England is estimated at about 5 feet 7 inches. I would like to get the bones back and bury them where they belong," Vujuvi said. After catching half a dozen piranhas, we glided to shore. Vujuvi gathered several sticks and built a fire. Without skinning the piranhas, he laid them on the wood, grilling one side, then the other. He put the blackened fish on a bed of leaves and tore several pieces off the bone. He wrapped the fish in beju, a kind of pancake bread made from manioc flour, handing each of us a sandwich. As we ate, he said, "I will tell you what my parents told me really happened to the Englishmen. It is true that they were here. There were 3 of them, and no one knew who they were or why they had come. They had no animals and carried packs on their backs. One, who was the chief, was old, and the 2 others were young. They were hungry and tired from marching for so long, and the people in the village gave them fish and beju. In return for their help, the Englishmen offered them fish hooks, which no one had seen before, and knives. Finally, the old man said, 'We must be going now.' The people asked them, 'Where are you going?' And they said, 'That way, to the east.' We said, 'Nobody goes that way. That's where the hostile Indians are. They will kill you.' But the old man insisted, and so they went." Vujuvi pointed eastward and shook his head. "In those days, nobody went that way," he said. "For several days," he continued, "the Kalapalos could see smoke above the trees, Fawcett's campfire. But on the 5th day, it disappeared." Vujuvi said that a group of Kalapalos, fearing that something bad had happened to them, tried to find their camp. But there was no trace of the Englishmen. I subsequently learned that what his parents had shared with him was an oral history, which had been passed down for generations with remarkable consistency. In 1931, Vincenzo Petrullo, an anthropologist who worked for the Pennsylvania University Museum in Philadelphia and who was one of the first whites to enter the Xingu, reported hearing a similar account, though amid all the sensationalist tales, few had paid much attention to it. Some 50 years later, Ellen Basso, an anthropologist at the University of Arizona, recorded a more detailed version from a Kalapalo named Kambi, who was a boy when Fawcett and his party arrived in the village. She translated his account directly from the Kalapalo language, maintaining the epic rhythms of the tribe's oral histories. "One of them remained by himself. While he sang, he played a musical instrument. His musical instrument worked like this, like this. He sang and sang. He put his arm around me this way. While he was playing, we watched the Christians. While he was playing. Father and the others. Then, 'I'll have to be going,' he said." Kambe also recounted how they could see their fire. "There's the Christians' fire," we said to one another. That was going on as the sun set. The next day, as the sun set, again their fire rose up. The following day again, just a little smoke, spread out in the sky. On this day, Mbuk, their fire had gone out. It looked as if the Englishman's fire was no longer alive, as if it had been put out. What a shame! Why did he keep insisting they go away?" When Vujuvi finished his version of the oral history, he said, "People always say the Kalapalos killed the Englishmen, but we did not. We tried to save them." Chapter 24. The Other World. The room was dark. Nina Fawcett sat on one side of a table. On the other was a woman peering into a crystal ball. Nina, after years of searching for her husband and son in this world, had begun to look in another dimension. She surrounded herself with psychics and soothsayers, many of whom sent her long letters detailing their attempts to contact the explorers. One medium told her that she was conscious of a presence in the room and, looking up, saw Fawcett standing by the window. The medium said that she asked him, "Are you alive or dead?" And Fawcett laughed and replied, "Can't you see that I'm alive?" He added, "Give my love to Nina and tell her we are all right." On another occasion, a medium reported that a younger figure with a long beard floated before her. It was Jack. "We shall see you someday," he said. Then he vanished, leaving a most beautiful scent behind. Fawcett's brother, Edward, told the RGS of Nina's descent into the occult. "Her life flows more easily thus." She was not the only one who turned to psychics to find answers to what the visible world stubbornly refused to reveal. Toward the end of his life, Reeves, Fawcett's mentor at the RGS, had shocked his colleagues by becoming a spiritualist, or what was sometimes called a spiritual surveyor. In the 1930s, he attended seances, searching for clues to Fawcett's fate. So did Fawcett's friend Sir Ralph Paget, the former Brazilian ambassador. In the early 1940s, while attending a gathering in Seaford, England, at the house of the psychic Nell Montague, Paget placed a letter from Fawcett on the medium's crystal ball. Montague said that she saw three flickering white figures. One lay motionless on the ground. Another, who was older, was struggling to breathe and was clutching at a man with long hair and a beard. The crystal ball suddenly turned red, as if it were drenched in blood. Then Montague said she saw Indians with spears and arrows carrying off the three white men. The people in the room gasped. For the first time, Paget felt that his friend was dead. In 1949, Geraldine Cummins, a celebrated practitioner of automatism, whereby a person purportedly goes into a trance and writes down messages from spirits, described how Jack and Raleigh were massacred by Indians. "Pain! Stop pain!" Raleigh gasped before dying. Fawcett, Cummins reported, eventually collapsed in a state of delirium. "The voices and sounds became a distant murmur as I now faced the grayness of death. It is a moment of unearthly horror, a time when the universe seems implacable and abiding loneliness apparent as the destiny of man." Although Nina dismissed such reports, she knew that she was facing her own mortality. Even before Cummins's prophecy, Brian Fawcett, who was caring for Nina in Peru, wrote to Joan, "I really don't think her days on Earth will be many." She herself would be the first to claim she was breaking up. Once, Nina woke at 2 a.m. and wrote to Joan that she had a vision that she must be prepared for the call at any moment. She thought, "Have you really and truly asked yourself? Have I any fear of death and the hereafter?" She hoped her passing would be easy. "Perhaps I would go to sleep and not wake up." Brian told his sister, "In a way, it would be a good thing for her to go out here. There would be a rather pleasing thought in her leaving her remains in the same continent as her husband and son." With her health deteriorating, Nina told Brian that she needed to give him something important. She opened a trunk, revealing all of Fawcett's logbooks and diaries. "The time has come to hand over to you all the documents in my possession," she said. Though Brian was only in his late 30s, his life had been scarred by death. Not only had he lost his father and brother, but his first wife had died of diabetes when she was 7 months pregnant. He had since remarried, yet there were no children, and he suffered spells of what he called wild, despairing sorrows. Brian now looked at his father's papers, which he described as the pathetic relics of a disaster whose nature we had no means of knowing. Over the next several weeks, he carried the papers to work with him. After more than 20 years as a railroad engineer, he was bored and restless. I feel that I am wasting my life, just going to a lousy office every day, signing a lot of stupid papers, and driving back again, he confided to Joan. It leads nowhere. He went on, Others can find immortality in their children. That is denied me, and I want to seek it. During his lunch break, he would read through his father's papers, picturing Fawcett on his expeditions, sharing with him the hardships, seeing through his eyes the great objective. Resentful about not being chosen for the expedition, Brian had once professed little interest in his father's work. Now he was consumed by it. He decided to quit his job and stitch together the fragmentary writings into Exploration Fawcett. As he worked tirelessly on the manuscript, Brian told his mother, Daddy seems very close to me, as though I were collaborating at his conscious direction. Naturally, there are times when it tugs at my heartstrings a lot. When Brian completed a draft in April 1952, he gave a copy to Nina, telling her, It really is quite a monumental work, and I think Daddy would have been proud of it. Lying in bed, Nina began to turn the pages. I simply couldn't put it down, she wrote to Joan. I bundled into my night clothes after supper and read that book till 4 a.m. It was as if her husband were right beside her. All the memories of him and Jack flooded into her mind. Upon finishing the manuscript, she exclaimed, Bravo! Bravo! The book, published in 1953, became an international sensation and was praised by Graham Greene and Harold Nicholson. Not long after, Nina died, at the age of 84. Brian and Joan had no longer been able to care for her, and she had been staying in a run-down boarding house in Brighton, England, demented and virtually penniless. As one observer noted, she had sacrificed her life to her husband and his memory. In the early 1950s, Brian decided to conduct his own expedition in search of the missing explorers. He suspected that his father, who would be approaching 90, was dead, and that Raleigh, owing to his infirmities, had perished soon after leaving Dead Horse Camp. But Jack, he was the cause of Brian's gnawing doubt. What if he had survived? After all, Jack was strong and young when the party had disappeared. Brian sent a letter to the British Embassy in Brazil, asking for help in securing permission to carry out a search effort. He explained that no one had legally presumed his brother dead, and that he could not do so without satisfying myself that all has been done. Moreover, such a mission might bring about the return to his own country of one who has been lost for 30 years. British officials thought Brian just as mad as his father, as one diplomat put it in a private communique, and refused to facilitate his suicide. Still, Brian forged ahead with his plans and boarded a ship to Brazil. His arrival there touched off a media storm. Britain to hunt dad, brother, lost in jungle, the Chicago Daily Tribune declared. Brian purchased an explorer's outfit and carried a sketchbook and logbook. A Brazilian who had been a friend of his father's gasped when he saw Brian. But, I thought you were dead, he said. Brian told his sister that he was becoming an explorer in spite of himself, but he knew that he would never survive trekking in the wilderness. Instead, relying on the means that Dr. Rice had pioneered decades earlier and that were now more affordable, he rented a tiny propeller plane and, with a pilot, canvassed the jungle from the air. He dropped thousands of leaflets that fluttered over the trees like snow. The leaflets asked, Are you Jack Fawcett? If your answer is yes, then make this sign holding arms above your head. Can you control the Indians if we land? He never received a response or found any evidence of Jack. But on another expedition, he looked for the object of his brother and father's quest, the City of Z. Fate must surely have guided my steps along this path for a purpose, Brian wrote. Peering through binoculars, he spied on a distant ridge a crumbling city with streets and towers and pyramids. That looks like it, the pilot shouted. But as the plane got closer, they realized that it was simply an outcropping of freakishly eroded sandstone. The illusion was remarkable, Almost unbelievable, Brian said. And as the days wore on, he began to fear what he had never allowed himself to consider, that there had never been a Z. As he later wrote, the whole romantic structure of fallacious beliefs, already rocking dangerously, collapsed about me, leaving me dazed. Brian started questioning some of the strange papers that he had found among his father's collection and never divulged. Originally, Fawcett had described Z in strictly scientific terms and with caution. I do not assume that the city is either large or rich. But by 1924, Fawcett had filled his papers with reams of delirious writings about the end of the world and about a mystical Atlantean kingdom, which resembled the Garden of Eden. Z was transformed into the cradle of all civilizations and the center of one of Blavatsky's White Lodges, where a group of higher spiritual beings helped to direct the fate of the universe. Fawcett hoped to discover a White Lodge that had been there since the time of Atlantis and to attain transcendence. Brian wrote in his diary, "Was Daddy's whole conception of Z a spiritual objective, and the manner of reaching it a religious allegory? Was it possible that three lives had been lost for an objective that had never existed?" Fawcett himself had scribbled in a letter to a friend, "Those whom the gods intend to destroy, they first make mad." Chapter 25. Z. "The cave is over in those mountains," the Brazilian businessman said. "That's where Fawcett descended into the subterranean city and is still alive." Before Paulo and I headed into the jungle, we had stopped in Barra do Garças, a town near the Roncador Mountains in the northeast corner of Mato Grosso. Many Brazilians had told us that, over the past few decades, religious cults had sprung up in the area that worshipped Fawcett as a kind of god. They believed that Fawcett had entered a network of underground tunnels and discovered that Z was, of all things, a portal to another reality. Even though Brian Fawcett had concealed his father's bizarre writings at the end of his life, these mystics had seized upon Fawcett's few cryptic references in magazines such as The Occult Review to his search for the treasures of the invisible world. These writings, coupled with Fawcett's disappearance and the failure of anyone over the years to discover his remains, fueled the notion that he had somehow defied the laws of physics. One sect, called the Magical Nucleus, was started in 1968 by a man named Udo Luckner, who referred to himself as the High Priest of the Roncador and wore a long white gown and a cylindrical hat with a Star of David. In the 1970s, scores of Brazilians and Europeans, including Fawcett's great-nephew, flocked to join the Magical Nucleus, hoping to find this portal. Luckner built a religious compound by the Roncador Mountains, where families were forbidden to eat meat or wear jewelry. Luckner predicted that the world would end in 1982 and said that his people must prepare to descend into the hollow earth. But when the planet remained in existence, the Magical Nucleus gradually disbanded. More mystics continued to come to the Roncador Mountains in search of this other world. One was the Brazilian businessman whom Paulo and I had encountered in the small town. Short and pudgy, and in his late 40s, he told us that he had been at a loss for my purpose in life when he had met a psychic who taught him about spiritualism and the underground portal. He said that he was now training to purify himself in the hopes of eventually going down. Amazingly, others were making similar preparations. In 2005, a Greek explorer had announced plans on an internet site, the Great Web of Percy Harrison Fawcett, which requires a secret code to access, for an expedition to find the same portal or the doorway to a kingdom that was entered by Colonel Fawcett in 1925. The trek, which has yet to take place, will include psychic guides and is billed as an expedition of no return in the ethereal place of the unbelief. It promises participants they will no longer be humans, but beings from another dimension, which means that we shall never die, we shall never get sick, and we shall never grow up. Just as the world's blank spaces were disappearing, these people had constructed their own permanent dreamscape. Before Paolo and I left, the businessman warned us, "You will never find Z as long as you look for it in this world." Not long after Paolo and I had met with the Kalapalos, I contemplated for the first time ending our search. Paolo and I were both tired and pocked with mosquito bites and had begun to quarrel. I had also come down with a severe stomach ailment, most likely from a parasite. One morning, I slipped away from the Kalapalo village with the satellite phone that I had brought. Paolo had advised me not to advertise that I had it, and I carried it in a small bag into the jungle. Crouching amid the leaves and vines, I removed the phone, trying to get a signal. After several failed tries, I received one and dialed home. "David, is that you?" Kyra asked, picking up. "Yes, yes, it's me," I said. "How are you? How's Zachary?" "I can't hear you very well. Where are you?" I looked up at the canopy. "Somewhere in the Xingu." "Are you okay?" "A little sick, but I'm okay." "I miss you." "Zachary wants to say something to you." A moment later, I could hear my son babbling. "Zachary, it's Daddy," I said. "Dada," he said. "Yes, Dada." "He's started calling the phone Dada," my wife said, taking back the receiver. "When are you coming home?"
"Soon."
"It hasn't been easy."
"I know. I'm sorry."
As I was talking, I heard someone approaching. "I gotta go," I said suddenly.
"What's going on?"
"Someone's coming." Before she could reply, I hung up the phone and slipped it back in the bag. In the same moment, a young Indian appeared, and I followed him back to the village. That night, as I lay in my hammock, I thought about what Brian Fawcett had said of his second wife after his expedition. I was all she had, he noted, and this situation need not have arisen. I chose it deliberately, selfishly, forgetting what it might mean to her in my eagerness to pursue an idea to its end. I knew that by then I had enough material to write a story. I had found out about the bones of Vesuvi's grandfather. I had heard the Kalapalo's oral history. I had reconstructed Fawcett's youth and training at the RGS and his last expedition. Yet there were gaps in the narrative that still haunted me. I had often heard about biographers who became consumed by their subjects, who, after years of investigating their lives, of trying to follow their every step and inhabit their world completely, were driven into fits of rage and despair because, at some level, the people were unknowable. Aspects of their characters, parts of their stories, remained impenetrable. I wondered what had happened to Fawcett and his companions after the Kalapalos saw their campfire go out. I wondered if the explorers had been killed by Indians, and if so, which ones. I wondered if Jack had reached a point when he began to question his father, and whether Fawcett himself, perhaps seeing his son dying, had asked, "What have I done?" And I wondered most of all whether there really was a Z. Was it, as Brian Fawcett feared, just a concoction of his father's imagination, or perhaps of all our imaginations? The finished story of Fawcett seemed to reside eternally beyond the horizon, a hidden metropolis of words and paragraphs, my own Z. As Cummins, channeling Fawcett, put it, "My story is lost, but it is a human soul's vanity to endeavor to disinter it and convey it to the world." The logical thing was to let go and return home. But there was one last person, I thought, who might know something more. Michael Heckenberger, the archaeologist from the University of Florida, whom James Peterson had recommended I get in touch with. During our brief phone conversation, Heckenberger had told me that he would be willing to meet me in the Quikuro village, which was north of the Kalapalo settlement. I had heard rumors from other anthropologists that Heckenberger had spent so much time in the Xingu that he had been adopted by the Quikuro chief and had his own hut in the village. If anyone might have picked up some fragmentary evidence or legend regarding Fawcett's final days, it would be him. And so I decided to press on, even though Brian Fawcett had warned others to stop throwing away their lives for a mirage. When I told Paolo, he gave me a quizzical look. It meant heading to the very place where James Lynch and his men had been kidnapped in 1996. Perhaps out of duty or resignation, Paolo said, "As you wish," and began to load our equipment into the Kalapalos aluminum canoe. With Vajuvi serving as our guide, we set out along the Kaluane River. It had rained most of the night before, and the river spilled into the surrounding forest. Usually, Paolo and I talked animatedly about our quest, but now we simply sat in silence. After several hours, the boat approached an embankment where a young Indian boy was fishing. Vajuvi steered the boat toward him and turned off the engine as the bow slid onto the shore. "Are we here?" I asked Vajuvi. "The village is inland," he said. "You'll have to walk from here." Paolo and I unloaded our bags and our boxes of food and said goodbye to Vajuvi. We watched as his boat disappeared behind a bend in the river. There was too much baggage for us to carry, and Paolo asked the boy if he could borrow his bicycle, which was propped against a tree. The boy agreed, and Paolo told me to wait while he went to find help. As he rode away, I sat under a buriti tree and observed the boy casting his line and pulling it in. An hour passed without anyone from the village appearing. I stood and stared down the path. There was only a trail of mud surrounded by wild grass and bushes. It was past noon when four boys showed up on bicycles. They strapped the cargo on the backs of their bicycles, but they had no room for a large cardboard box, which weighed about 40 pounds, or for my computer bag, and so I carried them myself. In a mixture of Portuguese, Quicuro, and pantomime, the boys explained that they would meet me in the village, waved goodbye, and vanished down the path on their rickety bikes. With the box resting on one shoulder and the bag in my hand, I followed on foot, alone. The path wound through a partially submerged mangrove forest. I wondered whether I should remove my shoes, but I had no place to carry them, so I left them on, my ankles sinking in the mud. The vestiges of the path soon disappeared under water. I was unsure which way to go, and I veered to the right, where I thought I saw some trampled grass. I walked for an hour, and there was still no sight of anyone. The box on my shoulder had grown heavier, as had the bag for my laptop, which, among the mangroves, seemed like an absurdity of modern travel. I thought about leaving them behind, but there was no dry spot to be found. Occasionally, I slipped in the mud, falling to my knees in the water. Thorny reeds tore the skin on my arms and legs, causing trickles of blood. I yelled out Paolo's name, but there was no response. Exhausted, I found a grassy knoll that was only a few inches below the waterline and sat down. My pants filled with water as I listened to the frogs. The sun burned my face and hands, and I wiped muddy water on myself in a vain attempt to cool down. It was then that I removed from my pocket the map of the Xingu on which Paolo and I had sketched our route. The Z in the middle suddenly seemed ludicrous, and I began to curse Fawcett. I cursed him for Jack and Raleigh. I cursed him for Murray and Rattan and Winton. And I cursed him for myself. After a while, I stood again and tried to find the correct path. I walked and walked. In one spot, the water rose to my waist, and I lifted the bag and the box onto my head. Each time I thought that I had reached the end of the mangrove forest, a new swath opened up before me, large patches of tall, damp reeds clouded with piums and mosquitoes, which ate into me. I was slapping a mosquito on my neck when I heard a noise in the distance. I stopped, but didn't see anything. As I took another step, the noise grew louder. I called out once more for Paolo. Then I heard it again, a strange cackle, almost like laughter. A dark object darted in the tall grass, and another, and another. They were coming closer.
"Who's there?"
I asked in Portuguese. Another sound reverberated behind me, and I spun around. The grass was rustling, even though there was no wind. I walked faster, stumbling, trying to push through the reeds. The water deepened and widened until it resembled a lake. I was looking dumbfounded at the shore, some 200 yards ahead, when I noticed, tucked in a bush, an aluminum canoe. Though there was no paddle, I rested the box and my bag in it and climbed in, short of breath. Then I heard the noise again and bolted upright. Out of the tall reeds burst dozens of naked children. They seized the edges of the canoe and began to swim me across the lake, screaming with laughter the entire way. When we reached the shore again, I stumbled out of the canoe, and the children followed me up a path. We had reached the Quicuro village. Paulo was sitting in the shade of the nearest hut. "I'm sorry I didn't go back for you," he said. "I didn't think I could make it." His vest was draped around his neck, and he was sipping water from a bowl. He handed the bowl to me, and though the water hadn't been boiled, I drank it greedily, letting it spill around my neck. "Now you have some kind of real picture in your mind of what it was like for Fawcett," he said. "Now we go home, no?" Before I could reply, a Quicuro man came and told us to follow him. I paused for a moment uncertainly, then walked with him across the dusty central plaza, which was some 250 yards in diameter, the largest one, I was told, in the Xingu. Two fires had recently swept through the huts along the plaza's perimeter, the flames leaping from one thatched roof to the next, leaving much of the settlement in ashes. The Quicuro man paused outside one of the surviving homes and told us to enter. Near the door, I could see two magnificent clay sculptures, one of a frog, the other of a jaguar. I was admiring them when an enormous man stepped out of the shadows. He was built like Tamakafi, a mythical Xinguano fighter who, according to legend, had a colossal body, his arms as thick as thighs, his legs as big as a chest. The man wore only a thin bathing suit, and he had a bowl haircut that somehow made his stern face seem even more imposing. "I am Afukaka," he said, in a surprisingly soft, measured voice. It was clear he was the chief. He offered Paulo and me lunch, a bowl of fish and rice, which his two wives, who were sisters, served us. He seemed interested in the outside world and asked me many questions about New York, about the skyscrapers and restaurants. As we spoke, a sweet serenading sound filtered into the hut. I turned to the door as a group of women dancers and men with bamboo flutes entered. The men, who were naked, had covered their bodies with elaborate painted images of fish and tortoises and anacondas, the shapes weaving along their arms and legs, the orange and yellow and red colors gleaming with sweat. Around the eyes of most of them were black circles of paint, which resembled masks at a costume party. Their heads were topped with large, colorful feathers. Afukaka and Paulo and I stood up as the group crowded into the hut. The men stepped forward twice, then back, then forward again, all the time blowing their flutes, some of which were 10 feet long, beautiful pieces of bamboo that released humming tones, like wind catching an open bottle top. Several young girls with long black hair danced alongside the men, their arms slung over the shoulders of the person in front of them, forming a chain. They, too, were naked, except for strings of snail shells around their necks and a bark cloth triangle, or uluri, that covered their pubic area. Some of the pubescent girls had recently been held in seclusion, and their bodies were paler than those of the men. Their necklaces rattled as they stamped their feet, adding to the insistent rhythm of the music. The group circled us for several minutes, then ducked under the doorway and disappeared into the plaza, the sound of the flutes fading as the musicians and the dancers entered the next hut. I asked Afukaka about the ritual, and he said that it was a festival for fish spirits. "It is a way to commune with the spirits," he said. "We have hundreds of ceremonies, all beautiful." After a while, I mentioned Fawcett. Afukaka echoed almost precisely what the Kalapalo chief had told me. The fierce Indians must have killed them, he said. Indeed, it seemed likely that one of the more warlike tribes in the region, most likely the Suyas, as Aloike had suggested, or the Kayapos, or the Chavante, had slaughtered the party. It was improbable that all three Englishmen would have starved to death, given Fawcett's talent for surviving in the jungle for long periods. But that was as far as the evidence led me, and I felt a sudden resignation. Only the forest knows all, Paolo said. While we were talking, a curious figure appeared. His skin was white, although parts of it had been scalded red from the sun, and he had scruffy blonde hair. He wore baggy shorts and no shirt, and carried a machete. It was Michael Heckenberger. "So you made it," he said with a smile, looking at my drenched, dirty clothes. It was true what I had been told. He had been adopted by Afukaka, who had built him a hut right next to his own home. Heckenberger said that he had been doing research here on and off for the last 13 years. During that time, he had battled everything from malaria to virulent bacteria that made his skin peel off. His body was also once invaded by maggots, like Murray's. It was kind of horrifying, Heckenberger said. Because of the prevailing notion that the Amazon was a counterfeit paradise, most archaeologists had long ago abandoned the remote Xingu. They assumed it was an archaeological black hole, Heckenberger said, adding that Fawcett was the exception. Heckenberger knew the story of Fawcett well, and had even tried to conduct his own inquiry into his fate. I'm fascinated by him and what he did in that time period, Heckenberger said. He was one of these larger-than-life figures. Anyone who would jump in a canoe or march in here at a time when you know some of the Indians are going to try to... He stopped in mid-sentence, as if contemplating the consequences. He said that Fawcett was easy to dismiss as a crank. He lacked the tools and the discipline of a modern archaeologist, and he never questioned the shibboleth that any lost city in the Amazon had to have European origins. But even though Fawcett was an amateur, he went on, he was able to see things more clearly than many professional scholars. I want to show you something, Heckenberger said at one point. Holding his machete in front of him, he led Paolo, Afukaka, and me into the forest, cutting away tendrils from trees, which shot upward, fighting for the glow of the sun. After walking for a mile or so, we reached an area where the forest thinned. Heckenberger pointed to the ground with his machete. "See how the land dips?" he asked. Indeed, the ground seemed to slope downward for a long stretch, then tilt upward again, as if someone had carved out an enormous ditch. "It's a moat," Heckenberger said. "What do you mean, a moat?" "A moat. A defensive ditch." He added, "from nearly 900 years ago." Paolo and I tried to follow the moat's contours, which curved in a nearly perfect circle through the woods. Heckenberger said that the moat had originally measured between a dozen and 16 feet deep and about 30 feet wide. It was nearly a mile in diameter. I thought of the long, deep ditches that the spirit Fitzi Fitzi was said to have built around settlements. The Kuikuros knew they existed, but they didn't realize that their own ancestors had built them, Heckenberger said. Afukaka, who had helped with the excavation, said, "We thought they were made by the spirits." Heckenberger walked over to a rectangular hole in the ground where he had excavated part of the moat. Paolo and I peered over the edge with the chief. The exposed earth, in contrast to other parts of the forest, was dark, almost black. Using radiocarbon dating, Heckenberger had dated the trench to about AD 1200. He pointed the tip of his machete to the bottom of the hole, where there seemed to be a ditch within the ditch. "That's where they put the palisade wall," he said. "A wall?" I asked. Heckenberger smiled and went on. "All around the moat, you can see these funnel shapes, equally spread apart. There are only two explanations. Either they had traps at the bottom, or they had something sticking into them, like tree trunks." He said that the concept of traps for invading enemies to fall into was unlikely, since the people the moat was supposed to be protecting would have been in peril themselves. What's more, he said, when he examined the moats with Afukaka, the chief told him a legend about Kuikuro, who had escaped from another village by leaping over a great palisade wall and ditch. Still, none of it seemed to make sense. Why would anyone build a moat and a stockade wall in the middle of the wilderness? There's nothing here, I said. Heckenberger didn't respond. Instead, he bent down and rooted through the dirt, picking up a piece of hardened clay with grooves along the edges. He held it up to the light. Broken pottery, he said. It's everywhere. As I looked at other shards on the ground, I thought of how Fawcett had insisted that on certain high areas in the Amazon, very little scratching will produce an abundance of ancient pottery. Heckenberger said that we were standing in the middle of a vast ancient settlement. Poor Fawcett. He was so close, Paolo said. The settlement was in the very region where Fawcett believed it would be. But it was understandable why he might not have been able to see it, Heckenberger went on. There isn't a lot of stone in the jungle, and most of the settlement was built with organic materials, wood and palms and earth mounds, which decompose, he said. But once you begin to map out the area and excavate it, you are blown away by what you see. He began walking once more through the forest, pointing out what were clearly the remains of a massive man-made landscape. There was not just one moat, but three, arranged in concentric circles. There was a giant circular plaza where the vegetation had a different character from that of the rest of the forest, because it had once been swept clean. And there had been a sprawling neighborhood of dwellings, as evidenced by even denser black soil, which had been enriched by decomposed garbage and human waste. As we walked around, I noticed an embankment that extended into the forest in a straight line. Heckenberger said that it was a road curb. They had roads, too? I asked. Roads? Causeways? Canals? Heckenberger said that some roads had been nearly 150 feet wide. We even found a place where the road ends at one side of a river in a kind of ascending ramp, and then continues on the other side with a descending ramp. Which can only mean one thing. There had to have been some kind of wooden bridge connecting them, over an area that was a half a mile long. They were the very same kinds of dreamlike causeways and settlements that the Spanish conquistadores had spoken of when they visited the Amazon, the ones in which Fawcett had so fervently believed and which 20th century scientists had dismissed as myths. I asked Heckenberger where the roads led, and he said that they extended to other, equally complex sites. I just took you to the closest one, he said. Altogether, he had uncovered 20 pre-Columbian settlements in the Xingu, which had been occupied roughly between AD 800 and AD 1600. The settlements were about 2 to 3 miles apart and were connected by roads. More astounding, the plazas were laid out along cardinal points from east to west, and the roads were positioned at the same geometric angles. Fawcett said the Indians had told him legends that described many streets set at right angles to one another. Borrowing my notebook, Heckenberger began to sketch a huge circle, then another and another. These were the plazas and the villages, he said. He then drew rings around them, which he said were the moats. Finally, he added several parallel lines that jutted out from each of the settlements in precise angles, the roads, bridges, and causeways. Each form seemed to fit into an elaborate whole, like an abstract painting whose elements cohere only at a distance. Once my team and I started to map everything out, we discovered that nothing was done by accident, Heckenberger said. All these settlements were laid out with a complicated plan, with a sense of engineering and mathematics that rivaled anything that was happening in much of Europe at the time. Heckenberger said that before Western diseases devastated the population, each cluster of settlements contained anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 people, which means that the larger community was the size of many medieval European cities. These people had a cultural aesthetic of monumentality, he said. They liked to have beautiful roads and plazas and bridges. Their monuments were not pyramids, which is why they were so hard to find, They were horizontal features, but they're no less extraordinary. Heckenberger told me that he had just published his research in a book called The Ecology of Power. Susanna Hecht, a geographer at UCLA's School of Public Affairs, called Heckenberger's findings extraordinary. Other archaeologists and geographers later described them to me as monumental, transformative, and earth-shattering. Heckenberger has helped to upend the view of the Amazon as a counterfeit paradise that could never sustain what Fawcett had envisioned, a prosperous, glorious civilization. Other scientists, I discovered, were contributing to this revolution in archaeology, which challenges virtually everything that was once believed about the Americas before Columbus. These archaeologists are often aided by gadgets that surpass anything Dr. Rice could have imagined. They include ground-penetrating radar, satellite imagery to map sites, and remote sensors that can detect magnetic fields in the soil to pinpoint buried artifacts. Anna Roosevelt, a great-granddaughter of Theodore Roosevelt's, who is an archaeologist at the University of Illinois, has excavated a cave near Santarém in the Brazilian Amazon that was filled with rock paintings, renditions of animal and human figures similar to those that Fawcett had described seeing in various parts of the Amazon, and that bolstered his theory of Z. Buried in the cave were remains of a settlement at least 10,000 years old, about twice as old as scientists had estimated the human presence in the Amazon. Indeed, the settlement is so ancient that it has cast doubt on the long-held theory of how the Americas were first populated. For years, archaeologists believed that the earliest American inhabitants were the Clovis, named for the spear points found in Clovis, New Mexico. It was thought that these big game hunters had crossed the Bering Strait from Asia at the end of the Ice Age and settled in North America around 11,000 years ago, and then gradually migrated down to Central and South America. The Amazon settlement, however, may be as old as the first undisputed Clovis settlement in North America. Moreover, according to Roosevelt, the telltale signs of the Clovis culture, such as spears with distinctly fluted rock points, were not present in the Amazon cave. Some archaeologists now believe that there may have been a people that preceded the Clovis. Others, like Roosevelt, think that the same people from Asia simultaneously radiated throughout the Americas and developed their own distinct cultures. In the cave and at a nearby riverbank settlement, Roosevelt made another astonishing discovery. 7,500-year-old pottery, which predates by more than 2,000 years the earliest pottery found in the Andes or Mesoamerica. This means that the Amazon may have been the earliest ceramic-producing region in all the Americas, and that, as Fawcett radically argued, the region was possibly even a wellspring of civilization throughout South America, that an advanced culture had spread outward rather than vice versa. Using aerial photography and satellite imaging, scientists have also begun to find enormous man-made earth mounds, often connected by causeways across the Amazon. In particular, in the Bolivian floodplains, where Fawcett first found his shards of pottery and reported that wherever there are alturas, that is, high ground above the plains, there are artifacts. Clark Erickson, an anthropologist from the University of Pennsylvania who has studied these earthworks in Bolivia, told me that the mounds allowed the Indians to continue farming during seasonal floods and to avoid the leaching process that can deprive the soil of nutrients. To create them, he said, required extraordinary labor and engineering. Tons of soil had to be transported, the course of rivers altered, canals excavated, and interconnecting roadways and settlements built. In many ways, he said, the mounds rival the Egyptian pyramids. Perhaps most startling is evidence that the Indians transformed the landscape even where it was a counterfeit paradise, that is to say, where the soil was too infertile to sustain a large population. Scientists have uncovered throughout the jungle large stretches of terra preta do índio, or Indian black earth, soil that has been enriched with organic human waste and charcoal from fires so that it is made exceptionally fertile. It is not clear if Indian black earth was an accidental byproduct of human inhabitation or, as some scientists think, was created by design, by a careful and systematic charring of the soil with smoldering fires, like the Kayapos practice in the Xingu. In either case, many Amazonian tribes appear to have exploited this rich soil to grow crops where agriculture was once thought inconceivable. Scientists have uncovered so much black earth from ancient settlements in the Amazon that they now believe the rainforest may have sustained millions of people. And for the first time, scholars are reevaluating the El Dorado chronicles that Fawcett used to piece together his theory of Z. As Roosevelt put it, what Carvajal described was without question no mirage. Scientists have admittedly not found evidence of the fantastical gold that the conquistadores had dreamed of. But the anthropologist Neil Whitehead says, with some caveats, El Dorado really did exist. Heckenberger told me that scientists were just beginning the process of understanding this ancient world, and like the theory of who first populated the Americas, all the traditional paradigms had to be reevaluated. In 2006, evidence even emerged that, in some parts of the Amazon, Indians built with stone. Archaeologists with the AMAPA Institute of Scientific and Technological Research uncovered, in the northern Brazilian Amazon, an astronomical observatory tower made of huge granite rocks. Each one weighed several tons, and some were nearly 10 feet tall. The ruins, believed to be anywhere from 500 to 2,000 years old, have been called the Stonehenge of the Amazon. Anthropologists, Heckenberger said, made the mistake of coming into the Amazon in the 20th century and seeing only small tribes and saying, well, that's all there is. The problem is that by then, many Indian populations had already been wiped out by what was essentially a Holocaust from European contact. That's why the first Europeans in the Amazon described such massive settlements that, later, no one could ever find. As we walked back into the Cuicuro village, Heckenberger stopped at the edge of the plaza and told me to examine it closely. He said that the civilization that had built the giant settlements had nearly been annihilated. Yet a small number of descendants had survived, and we were no doubt among them. For 1,000 years, he said, the Xinguanos had maintained artistic and cultural traditions from this highly advanced, highly structured civilization. He said, for instance, that the present-day Cuicuro village was still organized along east and west cardinal points, and its paths were aligned at right angles, though its residents no longer knew why this was the preferred pattern. Heckenberger added that he had taken a piece of pottery from the ruins and shown it to a local maker of ceramics. It was so similar to present-day pottery, with its painted exterior and reddish clay, that the potter insisted it had been made recently. As Paolo and I headed toward the chief's house, Heckenberger picked up a contemporary ceramic pot and ran his hand along the edge, where there were grooves. "They're from boiling the toxins out of manioc," he said. He had detected the same feature in the ancient pots. "That means that 1,000 years ago, people in this civilization had the same staple of diet," he said. He began to go through the house, finding parallels between the ancient civilization and its remnants today. The clay statues, the thatched walls and roofs, the cotton hammocks. "To tell you the honest-to-God truth, I don't think there is anywhere in the world where there isn't written history, where the continuity is so clear as right here," Heckenberger said. Some of the musicians and dancers were circling through the plaza, and Heckenberger said that everywhere in the Cuicuro village, you can see the past in the present. I began to picture the flutists and dancers in one of the old plazas. I pictured them living in mound-shaped two-story houses, the houses not scattered, but in endless rows where women wove hammocks and baked with manioc flour, and where teenage boys and girls were held in seclusion as they learned the rites of their ancestors. I pictured the dancers and singers crossing moats and passing through tall palisade fences, moving from one village to the next along wide boulevards and bridges and causeways. The musicians were coming closer to us, and Heckenberger said something about the flutes, but I could no longer hear his voice over the sounds. For a moment, I could see this vanished world as if it were right in front of me. Z. This is Mark Deakins. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon, by David Gran. Executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2005-2009 by David Gran. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.